freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with a Brock and Salk podcast. Phase one of the... Stage one or phase one? What is this phase one we're in?
It's phase one.
Phase one. Couple weeks away, hopefully, from phase two. By the way, marked difference from phase one to phase two. That's like the biggest jump, don't you think, Brock? If you look at the four phases. Yeah. Like, once we get to phase two, I feel like people's moods will change considerably. Like, we're in phase two. That's
Yeah, I think so. And then phase three, another significant step. And phase four, it's go time.
Sure.
But as we get going here, I just want to warn you.
We're all going to get haircuts, man. That's really all that anybody cares. Like, just give me a haircut, man.
Barber's going to be open.
The Salk, we're coming very close to just shaving the, not the whole head, obviously, but the sideburn. Something's going to have to be done. Because
something's got to give.
Something's going to have to give. Because it's starting to grow out, away from my ears.
Oh.
And that's not a good look.
How's it look, Kyle? You're there, right?
Yeah, he's starting to look, he's like got like, well, excuse me, I was going to say college Salk, you know, he's kind of getting this edgy look, but college Salk, didn't you have a shaved head then?
Head,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
It's got to go,
hey,
man.
just want to warn you guys, too, that it could be one of those weird days. Took a melatonin last night, had a little sugar, had just a bizarre...
You didn't eat candy corn, did you?
Not candy corn, but just a bizarre dream. Jimbo Fisher, Kyle, flying in. I'm on the top of the Westin.
Are we better than that, Jimbo?
Jimbo's on a helicopter.
Did that to you, Jimbo?
Yeah, Jimbo's on a helicopter. He's somehow now the head coach at the University of Hawaii. Playing the Huskies in CenturyLink Field.
Jimbo's falling on hard times.
Yeah, rough.
But he's still flying a private
Jones track.
But he's flying a private helicopter, and I'm on the helipad on the top of the Westin. So, yeah, it's going to be just a bizarre day.
All right.
You guys know.
I have been, Brock, obsessed with this Jordan documentary in a way that has surprised even me. I love it. I absolutely love this. And you know how it usually goes for you and me. You have to like remind me that these things are on.
I think I did. Didn't I do that the first series?
You did, but I had already been DVRing. I knew.
Okay.
I was like up for it already. You did remind me, knowing me, which was great. I appreciate that. But I've been upset. First of all, they've been amazing. They've been incredibly well done. So that part's great. But I found the story to be really captivating. And it's I hated Michael Jordan. I hated him.
No.
I know it sounds crazy. But we've talked about this before. I mean, my philosophy on sports, especially as a kid, was if you are not on my favorite team and you're good, I hate you. And I don't think that's – I may be unusual. It may not be. I think it probably – some of it depends on where in the country you grow up. But yes. Magic Johnson's my favorite player along with James Worthy. The Lakers are my favorite team. And I hated all of their challengers. So I hated the
And you grew up in Southern California. So
no,
that
I
makes
grew up
sense.
In Boston. That's a different
issue. Oh, that's where the curveball comes
right.
in.
That's a little curveball. But whatever. We choose our favorite teams. Mine had been the Lakers and Magic. And look, I hated the Celtics. I hated the Rockets. I hated the Bulls. Right? I hated everyone on those teams. And I could kind of handle like the early 80s Sixers or the Pistons.
I was just going to say, why did you not list the Pistons on the
Because the
teams
Pistons, because they were both really rivals with the Celtics more than the Lakers. And because they were anti-Celtic, I could kind of be okay with the Pistons or the Sixers because really what I was doing was rooting against the Celtics, who I hated more than any team other than the Yankees.
I bet Larry Salk just loved that.
Oh, yeah, drum crazy.
He was just so proud of you.
Yeah.
Can we just start?
Bruins, Patriots, Lakers.
I need to know that. Can you just give me that? Because it's going to kind of, and I know we'll go in a bunch of different places, but yeah. Why the vitriol? You were a Patriots guy. You were a Red Sox guy. You were a huge Bruins guy.
Growing up when I was really young, first of all, nobody was really a Patriots guy. Like, I rooted for the Patriots, but, I mean, they were
bad.
They weren't bad. That's not even the right word for them. They were beyond bad. They were irrelevant. They were a joke. They were the worst franchise in sports. Literally. They were, of all of the sports franchises in all of the major leagues, they were the worst.
Worse than the Clippers were in the NBA?
Yeah, they embarrassed themselves on a yearly basis because it wasn't just that the bad play was coupled with, you know, like their stands catching on fire or the toilets blowing up at once or like it was embarrassing. Then you had Zeke Mowat eventually with Lisa Olsen, the sexual harassment thing. I mean, like, if it could go wrong, it would go wrong. Okay. And so, you know, everyone, you kind of rooted for the Patriots, but you knew they'd lose. And so, like, I love Dan Marino, so I kind of like the Dolphins, and I loved, you know, Lawrence Taylor, so I kind of like the Giants. But at the heart of it, I loved Magic Johnson. I just loved him. They're just that guy is so he's my favorite player. Okay. Absolutely adored him, and so I hated the Celtics. Anyway,
interesting.
It was hard for me to appreciate Jordan in his era and in his prime because I was so busy rooting against him. So it's kind of nice now to be able to go back without feeling that level of hatred and just kind of observe everything that made him Jordan.
And you think, and this is stuck in a way that no other really documentary series or anything has stuck for you because...
Well, I mean, he's a compelling character, but in some ways it's a little bit new to him, to me, because I'm watching it a little bit fresh. I'm not watching it just through the eyes of I hate this guy and I hope he loses. Like, I can watch the game. I can watch John Paxson hit that shot and think about, like, the greater situation of what was going on instead of being so furious that the Bulls had won again. Right. I mean, I can understand sort of the passing of the torch between Magic Bird and then to him without being mad that it was now Jordan's league. If that
you think
sense.
Our last 10 years with these Seahawks is also kind of gives us a what feels like a fresh look on what that team was for all of those years. Now, they're different battles. They're different fights. There's no Jerry Krause on the Seahawks. John Schneider's a pretty loved guy. You know, Pete and Phil, we talked about a week ago, are pretty similar characters. Certainly Marshawn and Rodman, there's some similar characters. Like, there's enough touch points, I think, between what we have watched day in, day out, so up close, so personal, been around that facility, all the conversations on those Mondays, Salk, that we had with Pete. You think that kind of gives us, I don't know, a little bit of a unique lens to look through this in any way?
You'll have to lead the way on this. How?
Well, I feel like after watching this documentary series of these Seahawks for 10 years, and really what this documentary on the Bulls and Jordan does, yes, Jordan is the centerpiece, but it's all about storytelling. And you're learning what you just said, all the behind the scenes with these different guys, with Phil, with Rodman, with Pippen, how all of them, you know, just in their character and their story development come together. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the hatred for Jerry Krause and the bitterness and all that goes through, somewhat similar to Richard and Bennett and those guys that became bigger than life and then ultimately fall out of favor with the organization. And just because it's been so fresh, and by the way, a championship, not six, but a championship in nearly a second, and huge success, unrivaled success in this town, in this market, for this Seahawk team that we have been so close to, does it just give you, I don't know, more touch points of understanding?
Maybe.
But it's also frustrating
because you don't get that dynastic thing.
No.
Unfortunately. I mean, like, look, Jordan didn't lose.
Nope.
Right? I mean, once he got there, once he rose to the pinnacle, and it took him some time to get there. And by the way, that shouldn't get overlooked, kind of the whole Larry and Michael thing. I mean, there's that great, great sequence where he's talking through the 1992 Dream Team practices and how he takes it to Magic Johnson and how he sort of declares, this is my team and my era, right?
Yeah.
I have a little fear that people, especially younger people who were not around then, will watch that and come away thinking, oh, well, Jordan was just much better than Magic and Bird. And I don't know that that's true. We never really got to see them match up prime for prime, right? I mean, those guys were about 5 or 6 years older, and I guess in their prime, they beat Jordan.
True.
Right? I mean, in their prime, they beat Jordan. Now, he didn't have Scottie Pippen. He didn't have the rest of the group around them that they did. You know, Magic had Worthy and Kareem, et cetera, and, you know, you have the McHale and Parrish. But they beat him.
Yep.
In their prime. He beat them in his prime. And there is, like, I hope that doesn't get lost. I hope Magic and Bird don't get treated as sort of an afterthought, because those guys ran the league for over a decade. And by the way, if one of them hadn't had the other, would they have won the same six championships?
Right.
Probably.
Right.
Right? I mean, they beat each other a couple of times. Would it have looked a little bit different if they each hadn't been there? Yeah, maybe. If you throw all those rings to the other and say, yeah, of course, the Lakers would have won without the Celtics, or vice versa. So, I don't know. I guess just being a kid when those guys were playing... It's
you
important.
You protect the 80s.
They have to be protected, like, a little bit here.
People better respect the 80s, all right?
They better respect the 80s NBA.
And there was a lot of good movies, and there was a lot of good music, and it was an age of technological advancement.
It's true.
And the basketball players were really good.
Generally, I don't mind protecting the 90s, but in this case, I feel like the 80s need a little help. got a
and Converse had their run. All right, don't hate on Converse.
I was glad to see the Converse weapon commercial was featured there.
They had the Chuck Taylors, and then that weapon was nasty. I mean, the black, were they black or dark green, the Celtics?
It was sort of right in between.
Larry's, yeah. Birds was wearing black. He was wearing, like, Johnny Unitas' yeah. cleats out there. That who was awesome. A throwback.
Dude, the Converse weapon... I've never owned a pair of Jordans, but I owned some Converse weapons yeah, when I was did. A kid. I had the white, gold, and purple one.
Oh, yeah,
you better did. Believe it. To go with my socks that had purple and gold stripes on them. Oh, yeah.
Brock, do you have Jordans? You can pull off Jordans. Salk and I can't pull off Jordans.
Never worn.
Yeah. Never pulled off Jordans.
Nope. Yeah, never, yeah. never worn.
Yeah, I mean, I was never a Jordan, big Jordan guy, and I have a ton of Jordans. But, yeah, I've had a few through the years. And they're pretty sweet.
Is it hard for other people to appreciate opposing players? Do other people end up hating the opposing players so much that you fail to appreciate them in their time?
Mm. Gosh, I feel like I'm going to spin this. I'm going to answer that.
Because you're better at it than me. Let's yes. just be clear.
Oh, for sure. For sure. You just have this vitriol.
I have no appreciation for Peyton Manning. I have no appreciation in his day for Michael Jordan.
No.
I mean, like, once I've chosen sides... Yes. That guy's done for me.
Like, yeah, I don't care.
I spend my entire time watching, hoping that they're going to lose, and probably like finding whatever flaw I
hurt.
Can possibly find. Not get hurt. Come on. No, that's not true.
I would say through six episodes, and we hit on this a little bit last week, but it just was even more clear this week. Through six episodes, and by the way, it's just primetime viewing, like 6 to 8. We're watching it. We're watching it as a family, whether it's outside or on the couch this week. We're just all hunkered down. We are watching this thing. I think the underlying theme every week really crystallized this week even more so when Molly and the kids bring it up is, my gosh, he hated those guys. There was that true vitriol and hatred for Isaiah Thomas. There was a hatred for Dan Marley. There was a hatred for Clyde Drake. He hated those guys.
Yep.
And why, you know, and I think Molly said, do you, you know, and asked a question that we've talked about before. Do you think we will ever see that again? You think we, or is it just that it is now they're all in the same club together? They're all just, you know, rolling in dough like never before. They have marketing agencies. They have their agencies that all work together. They put their own teams together that the players really are the ones that are truly running the show and putting their buddies together to play. Will we ever have just the vitriol?
I think you should with that, right? I mean, If I'm left out of the club, right? If LeBron decides he wants to play with Bosch and Wade and not me, shouldn't that create that same level of animosity?
It should.
And there is some in the NBA. I mean, they have their little wars and feuds, and we get some of it, but it feels petty instead of feeling like, you know, the Knicks and Bulls, which felt team-wide hatred, and that I think is really the difference. It's not just that Michael hated those guys, and we can come to that in a few minutes here. It's that the teams hated each other
in the cities.
Well, yeah, that too. I mean, that and yeah, a lot of them are back east, and you get sort of this sort of city by city hatred, right? You get, you know, Chicago and Detroit are pretty close to each other, right? I mean, Boston and New York, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, like all of those, it's easy to kind of build some of that hatred in then when it was team versus team.
The other thing I think they spoke to was that 92 Olympics was the first time these NBA players had come together to play together.
Right.
Nowadays, they spend summers together in Rio and Beijing, and they're all over. They're traveling together. That didn't used to be the case. These guys were on different teams at all times.
Yeah, and especially the guys who were on the East versus the West, because you didn't change teams that much. Magic and Larry had never played together. They even went up against each other in All-Star games, right? So he, you know, you heard that scene of Magic being like, oh, you guys would always get together in the East and come All-Star game. It was his first time playing with those guys.
Yeah.
So that part was interesting. I don't know, Brock, I think Michael Jordan would approve of me hating him.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely.
He'd love it. You guys are sitting at home right now disgusted with me for hating Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan would be disgusted with you for being disgusted with me. He would look at it and go, of course I'm hated by this guy. He likes the other team. Michael Jordan doesn't want me to like him. He wants me to hate him because he would feel exactly the same way.
Yeah, it's everybody, you know, and we have talked about this how many different times through how many different stories and characters in every sport is I just want to be liked, right? It is, you know, the Johnny Manziel. It's why the Johnny Manziel thing was never going to work And it's why Pete and I got into it about Johnny Manziel. And Pete's like, dude, well, you just gotta let him be who he is. But he's not. But he's not really that guy. He'll wear the black hat until it gets hot. And then he wants to take it off. And he still wants to be liked. And that's not really, you know, Baker Mayfield. We'll see. We'll see how much Baker Mayfield continues to kind of change his stripes, or if he tries to continue to go down that road. Because ultimately, I think people in this day and age, in the social world that we live in, right, as socially connected as we are, as much information is out there at everybody's fingertips. I mean, when it got hot in this last episode with the whole gambling deal, what did Michael do? He shut it down. Well, you could do that then. You could shut some of that stuff down then and not talk to the reporters. That ain't happening today in our socially connected world. You know, it'd be fascinating for him to have his whole life exposed out there as it is today for these guys. And so many of them want to be liked, you know, be liked by everybody. How many times do you say that about LeBron for 10 years, Salk? Right? That guy is a phony in your estimation. He wants to be liked. A-Rod, you know, wants to be liked. These guys just still, when push comes to shove, they want to be liked. And Michael, that wasn't his MO. He did not want to be liked by the Knicks, and he was hated by them. He didn't want the little Mike Salk to like him. You're right. He wanted you to hate him and to be his rival and to go up against. And I will also add this to, you know,
by the
it's
way,
not
he
just
would have
the
destroyed me too, because that's what he did to everybody else.
That's right. It's not just the fraternity of these guys today. Like when they get to the league, they hang out together and they play. These guys know of each other in fifth and sixth grade. Like they start playing in the AAU circuit, and we knew of LeBron as a ninth grader. Right, it goes back deep. Bird, Jordan didn't even make his high school team. Those guys had no connection whatsoever to any of the past, to any of the shoes, to any of the AU, to any of the clubs, to any of the college. They didn't know any, you know, any of them had any relationship. These guys have known each other largely for years and years and years on the circuit before they ultimately are one and done and try to get, you know, their career revving and going.
You know what,
NBA.
Though, if Jordan had that, he would have hated those guys even more. If he had grown up playing against all of them, he would have hated them even more.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he was truly fueled by it and still is. I mean, let's be clear. This documentary comes out, he releases this all because of the conversations about LeBron or Kobe being better than him.
Yeah. They said it was the day LeBron won the title in Cleveland. Jordan called and said, release the tapes.
I mean,
literally, that's not even a joke. That's when he's like, all right, release it.
He is fueled by this, and there's no doubt. And when you watch him, who did he do the dirtiest? Is it Kukoc, Drexler, or Isaiah?
Isaiah.
No. Trick question. It's Jerry Krause.
I think it was Jerry Krause.
Trick question.
Brutal on that guy.
It has nothing to do with any of the other players. His hatred is mostly for Jerry Krause.
That's true. He was as hard on his teammates as he was anyone else.
Absolutely. So is Krause secretly a genius? Is he secretly the genius for getting Jordan to hate him and use all that hate to fuel him and kind of bring the team together against him?
No.
Probably not.
I don't think I can't go there.
But it worked.
Not after listening to him espouse
it did work
the merits of the organization.
Oh my God.
After their second title.
Wasn't that bad?
Oh, gosh.
Now, if you didn't know any of this, because I didn't really at the time, I don't know whether you did, but would you have caught that otherwise?
Oh, I think so, yes. And again, this comes down to what I do, sadly, with so many things in life after having the job that we did, Salk, for every day of every year for our run is spinning everything back to Seattle. And yeah, I think like, oh, that's not John Schneider. John Schneider could have easily done that, but that's absolutely Richard Sherman. That's absolutely Pete. That's absolutely Bennett. That's absolutely the defense versus the offense. That's absolutely Doug. I mean, it's just this credit pie. Right. Like Jerry wanted a big fat slice of the credit pie for him and the organization. And
he
tried
it?
To say, oh, the ticket holders that, you know, the security guards, like organizationally, this is about the organization. We're the best organization. But you knew. Yes. I think I would have even not being cynical as I am at times and naive. I think I still picked up on that. Like, gosh, this guy just needs his slice of the credit.
I don't know that I would have caught it the other way. I mean, because it sounds like, you know, look, it's not just about one guy. It's about the team. I mean, he's trying to make an argument that you would hear from plenty of players and coaches and owners and GMs after a win. I mean, I don't think that's that weird. But in context, I mean, it's gross, and it feels like he's trying to strip the credit from Jordan in particular and maybe even the players in general. But on the other hand, and look, it does sound petty, Jordan didn't win anything until Krause got him the right pieces.
True.
I mean, like, you can say, well, he had Michael Jordan. True. But they didn't win until he got them Scottie Pippen. It's not like Scottie was a no-brainer, right? I mean, he brought in Horace Grant, and he brought all those
guys
in.
Well, and I think the big thing that I've learned, the biggest revelation in this, I did not remember that Phil Jackson was an assistant there. and then he brought in Tex Winters, you know, the best basketball guy in his mind, like, you know, and brought them together and then ultimately pulled the trigger and said, yeah, you know, that's, sorry, Doug Collins, you're a nice guy, but you're going to move out of the way. And I'm going to bring this brain trust in for this player and then, you know, get him his Robin. And yeah, I mean, he absolutely deserves a bunch of the credit. But what have you always said? Don't be the one talking about yourself. Well, let others talk about
you. In his view, he's not. He's talking about the, you know, the ball boys and stuff.
Right.
But, you know, the hatred for Jerry Krause seems to fuel the whole team. And yet it works, right? I mean, like, what does he care? All right, look badly on me. Okay. Like, okay, I'm the one. I got six rings, too.
Do you think about the Krause family watching this? Because I do.
Oh, it's tough.
Oh gosh, I can't wait. You know, when this comes out and maybe they got a little inkling, maybe the producers or directors sent him a note, like, you know, and he passed away in 2017, I believe Jerry did. But, you know, I'm sure he has family and kin and like, just let you know that this isn't going to be real favorable. Yeah. Like, seriously, how hard would that be watching this series of, you know, my dad or my uncle or, you know, my family member, Jerry was part of six titles. He was the GM. He brought the coach in and the assistant coaches in and he brought Scottie Pippen and he turned it over after the first three and brought new pieces and everything we praise Belichick and the New England and everything that they've done. He found the next Paxson and John Kerr and he found the next Bill Cartwright and Bill Wennington and Luke Longley. And he found the next, like, he just kept finding the pieces to have that dynastic run to surround Jordan. And this could not be a bigger poop parade on the whole Krause name. I mean, through six episodes, he is the bad guy.
He is. And I, you know, obviously I wouldn't be hard if you were his family watching some of that. The person I'd like to hear a little more from is Reinsdorf. Cause he's sort of able to triangulate some of that.
It's the same thing. They showed him a lot in that first week. He kind of disappeared. And then he just vanished.
Cause he gives a little bit of the other side of it. If Krause isn't here to speak for himself, which is unfortunate. You know, I thought Reinsdorf could give a little bit more of that. You know, the other thing they covered this past week was just the whole marketing the cultural phenomenon of Jordan, and it is amazing, right?
Yes,
seeing David Falk as agent talking about marketing him like a tennis player, and like it sort of shows you just how much things have changed. But is Nike the most important company in terms of culture in our lifetime? There's probably two others that would run with it. I mean, Microsoft's the most successful company and Amazon, obviously.
Yes.
Apple, I would argue, has right there in terms of changing culture.
Yes.
And Facebook in terms of changing culture, right? Just the beginning of social media becoming such a massive change to the way the world operates. But maybe culture isn't quite the right word then. Maybe it's style and taste and some of that. But it just feels like Nike is so enormously important.
Agreed. And really, I think what they learned with Jordan, they then parlayed into Tiger, right? And those two icons in just the most unique ways. And Tiger, gosh, there'd be a fascinating debate and conversation about, you know, what he did to that game in that sport and socially beyond sport. For Michael, you know, it was largely basketball, and he didn't have to break the barriers that Tiger had to break in that game. But all the lessons they took from growing, I think, that Jordan brand into what they did with Tiger and golf were just unbelievably profound. And it's hard to imagine another athlete coming along and having that kind of impact. Like, as I sit in there and watch that today, are we going to see another athlete in our lifetime in any of these sports have that kind of connection, be it to Nike or a different brand? It's just hard for me. I'm not a visionary in that way anyhow, but it's just hard to fathom that you're going to, you know, it's kind of like that team when they win their first title. There's nothing like the first.
Yeah,
you know, you can bring Kobe, you can bring Garnett, you can bring Shaq, you can bring other brands, and Tom Brady has his brand, and Roger Federer has his brand, and Russell Wilson got his brand.
Because at this point, Nike, and those things are machines.
Yeah.
Like defeating Nike now is a much different challenge than it was to defeat Congress or Converse at the time.
Or Congress.
Did you say Congress?
You don't want to go to... Yeah, they'll take you down. Trust me. They'll start hearings of independent prosecutors.
Filibusters. Yeah. It gets sticky.
It was sort of the Wild West then, right? And so I think Nike has such a stranglehold, and all the big companies do, on how that stuff works now. Will it ever happen again? Maybe. I mean, there could be another cultural phenomenon like that. You think that we're done? I don't think we're done.
No, I just, no, but it's just, golly, when you are the first and the biggest, so hard to imagine basketball will ever have it. We've seen with football, Tom Brady's success as the GOAT in 10 Super Bowls and 6 titles and everything else, and he is the unquestioned, like, his brand of football is such a different game, right? Maybe soccer, maybe there's the next, you know, Messi that comes along and is even greater. Maybe there's somebody breaks Usain Bolt, you know, that runs a sub-9 second.
An individual athlete that kind of pulls that off. Sure.
Correct.
But I don't know. I just, you're right. I mean, it's sort of the perfect combination of what he did on the court, the image he was able to present, what people were looking for at the time, and then these major brands, three of the biggest brands, you know, Nike, Gatorade, and McDonald's, and then, I mean, eventually Hanes. But the way those brands and those advertising agencies took advantage of it is unbelievable. For all of the connection to Nike, and that's the company he's most associated with, I guess I had kind of forgotten that the Be Like Mike song was Gatorade.
Right.
I mean, like, I guess if you had asked me, I would have figured it out. But I don't necessarily associate it with Gatorade the way I do the Spike Lee commercials with Nike or the ones with Charles Barkley with McDonald's where they're playing horse. I mean, those are like the three great Jordan commercials, I think, when I think about them. But it's that Gatorade song that kind of shows off the perfect ideal that he couldn't live up to.
Yeah. Can I give you two more quick little takeaways on this? Basically, these are takeaways and tidbits. Sports goes in cycles. We say that all the time. Will basketball ever be a physical game like it was in the 80s and 90s?
No.
Can you imagine going back and having the Anthony Masons and the Charles Oakleys and just to like go out there and physically?
No.
Like
another reason we can blame analytics, because everyone just wants to stand outside the 3-point line and jack up shots. Yeah, and no one wants to go into the paint and like get clubbed.
Right.
So, yeah.
When you foul somebody and they're physical off a 3-pointer, it's really obvious.
Yes.
It's not like the bumping, you know, whatever thing else that went inside where you could kind of let it go. You're out there on an island with a spotlight on you and you get, you know,
it's
crushed.
All about getting space and everyone being far away from each other, no contact.
Would you kind of like to see a team like in the NBA, right? We hear about this all the time. And man, I remember the Graz father way back when, like the decade of darkness, he called it with the Sonics, when they were going to lose their stars. Like it takes forever to rebuild back an NBA team and to build that dynasty and da 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 da. Like, could you imagine a team just saying, we're going all in. I'm finding the next Oakley and Anthony Mason, and we're just going to beat you up.
Where would they find them? Where would they find them?
The Sonics did. I mean, they had like Danny Fortson, Nick Collison, Calvin Booth. Like, they tried to go
George,
with some dudes.
They'd say to George Fant, don't go play tight end. Keep playing basketball, and you know what? We will draft you, you know, and take you, and you're going to just come beat people up.
Because those guys were actually pretty good. I mean, like, Rodman was a great player, was a great rebounder. I mean, like, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's ever going to. By the way, just while you're talking about that and the physical play, I can't, to this day, I can't watch Charles Smith. It's so hard to watch. It's that poor guy. He's got so many attempts to win that game.
Yes.
And if they win that game, I do think that they win the series. And he just can't do it.
And
he
once just, again, by the way, like if you're Charles Smith watching that, or his kids are like, Dad, I thought, Dad, I could just imagine Titus.
I mean, that's been happening for him. No,
I could just imagine if that was my Titus sitting there as we're watching it, right? He'd be like, Dad, you sucked. Why didn't you make that? You had four shots at it, Dad. You were terrible.
Poor guy. Just, it's so sad. Titus. Everybody blocks it. It's the most famous defensive sequence in history.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Havlicek stealing the ball, right? I mean, so there's like a couple of major steal, Bird stole the ball. But in terms of a whole sequence of events defensively, that's got to be the most famous of all time, right?
Pretty tough. We had a tough one here, Mike, way back when with the Huskies, with McCulloch and Patrick Femerling and Rip Hamilton. And like, it went the other way, unfortunately. Like, there was a block and just get the ball. Just please pick up the ball. Just pick up the ball. And then, of course, Rip Hamilton.
So UConn, like 99?
Yeah. We had a tough one a little bit. Okay, last thing, my last little takeaway on this. Why does it feel like Kobe was more influential on culture than LeBron's been? I could see a Kobe 10-part series, you know, 20 years from now. I feel like I could see a Kobe one more so than I could see a LeBron one.
No. I totally disagree with that.
Really?
Totally disagree. I mean, the Kobe, there'd be a good couple of good pieces to it, but I mean, LeBron went from team to team, and there's drama, and there's you know, a story that would need to be told about what happened. Why does he keep breaking up with these other stars? How did he choose to go from one place to another, coming back to Cleveland to win? I mean, I think it's a much more engaging story than Kobe's. And that's not to say Kobe's isn't great also. And certainly I'd love a documentary just on the Kobe versus Shaq thing, whatever, like, finally made that thing end. But yep. I don't think so. I think the LeBron story is filled with so many more twists and turns.
Kyle?
Yeah, I think so.
More LeBron?
Yeah, more LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a longer story, more diverse story, and certainly that, you know,
since he was a freshman in high school,
right?
Watching him on ESPN at St. Vincent St. Mary's, he was having to cover up his tattoos, and I remember everything about him coming up.
Yeah, and Kobe's a great player and a fascinating story in his own right. So I'm not trying to take a shot at that.
I guess I just see many, I'll try to argue. I can't argue the length of story, the narrative, the different characters, the cities, bringing Cleveland a title. There's no question that just from like the plot and the number of different characters and the turns, there's no question that's LeBron. I guess it's just when you hear the Doug Baldwins or the Michael Bumpuses or the Kyle Brown say, oh yeah, here's a Kobe. Yeah, that's a Kobe. Like, in his Mamba mentality and just that mentality that, I don't know if I hear that or feel that with LeBron. He's an amazing talent. He's unbelievably gifted. He's one of the greatest. There's a debate between him and MJ if you want it.
I don't know. I think I'll disagree with you. I think some of that is true because of Kobe's passing. But you know, you hear different things about LeBron. And I'm no big LeBron fan, obviously. I mean, I've taken my shots at LeBron over the years because I do think he's acted in a pretty phony way at a lot of times. I thought it was weak the way he chose his buddies to go try to win a title together. But, you know, what he's done for community and for people around, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think it's a different impact than Kobe has had. And yeah. I don't know that it's fair to say that Kobe's has been greater. I think LeBron has had a pretty enormous influence on the community. And by the way, you know, you and I spent a lot of time talking about that moment they stood up at the ESPYs together, and they were both there for that, right? I mean, that was Kobe and LeBron and, you know, Dwayne Wade and a couple other guys. I don't know. I don't know that I can agree with you on that one. I get what you're saying, but I think I'd rather watch a LeBron one. The one I really want to watch, and it's not a 10-part documentary. It's really just, I wish they had followed him every minute of the day for a few years, is Shaq.
Mm.
Can you imagine how much fun the Shaq one would be? It doesn't have nearly the same amount of drama in it. He's not fueled by hatred in the same way. But how entertaining would, like, 2-3 years of just following Shaq around everything he did?
Why do I picture him, though, in, like, a hotel bed? Like, Jordan was laying on that couch smoking a cigar, right, all day, just laying. Like, why do I picture Shaq just hunkered down, like, eating, chilling, smoking a cigar? Like, just, I'm not leaving my room until I absolutely have to.
You ever met Shaq?
He's gigantic.
No.
Have you ever met
Shaq?
Yes. And what? In the locker room. I mean, just, you know, covering the Celtics. He came in, I think, with the Cavs.
Was this after your shower with Garnett?
It might have been the same year. I mean, who can remember?
We were in the same game.
But he was playing for Cleveland for a year, right?
Was that when he was the big Aristotle?
Because
he was the big cactus in Cleveland. Well, he was the big leprechaun, I believe, in
Boston. He was the Shaqtus.
He was the Shaqtus. Yeah. I think he was the big Aristotle.
Gigantic.
Guy. It's shocking how big he is. Like, when you are faced with him, he just keeps going.
Mm.
It's really just, he's enormous.
Do you think there's, lastly, any footage of the Seahawks in this run? You think there's enough camera phone footage? Do you think there's anybody? Obviously, Russ has had his East to West empire doing his thing in his marketing. Do you think there's any footage like this over the last 10 years of that run with Bennett and Sherman and Doug and all of that?
Nope.
You think we could ever see anything like this from a behind the scenes, or this was just the wherewithal that Michael had, especially in 98, to go, man, it's going to be a special year?
I'll tell you what, man. If there was, whoever got to control it would tell the most fascinating story, but it could change so much depending on who got to tell the story.
True.
Right?
through Golden Tate's eyes.
Right. And a lot of the criticism of this documentary, including by Ken Burns, like the great documentarian, is that Jordan's got way too much say in this.
Jordan
gets to tell how all this went down. Oh, Horace Grant, yeah, he ratted. He was the source. He was a snitch for all the book. Well, maybe.
Well, Horace Grant says afterwards I wasn't.
Yeah, yes. But they just let Michael, like, oh, Michael can say whatever he wants. He can make whatever claim he wants.
I love that about it, though. That's what makes it more fun
but
to watch.
But that's why it's not, like, a documentary.
I don't care.
It's just Michael Jordan telling his own story.
I don't care that it's a documentary
or not. Which is fantastic.
It's so much more interesting.
But it's just not as true.
I don't care. I'm not interested in the truth.
He tells the story about the trip to Atlantic City, and in present time, he's like, oh, it's just me and my dad going out there.
Right.
But then they show the video from 93 where he's like, oh, me and my dad and my boys, we got in a limo. And it's like, oh, see how that story has changed over 20 years.
I kind of like that.
It's just me and my dad, no big deal.
Well, yeah.
If they talked to his real buddies, we would have known, like, oh, me and MJ, we got in that thing with three bottles or whatever, and we drank the whole way down there, and we partied all night. But now it's like,
he was down there with that sketchy golf dude.
Yeah, who was that guy? And why were his golf clubs in the courtroom sketch? Did he bring?
That's what I was wondering.
Did he caddy them into the courtroom?
Same question.
Wait, what?
Why does he have his golf clubs with him?
Did he just come from the 18th green straight to the courthouse?
Is that considered some sort of a weapon that you can't bring into the courthouse?
Was it evidence?
How did he get it in there?
What?
It was a caddy bag, too, so it stood up
nice. Yeah,
it's
like a big tour bag.
Dragging that thing in. He's sort of walking
by. Somebody get my club!
He's sort of walking by people and accidentally bumping. Sorry, excuse me. Sorry about that. I got to carry my bag.
I had tea time at 1:30.
Well, it has been an interesting time kind of doing some of this reflecting back, right? We've talked about some of the stuff that's been on and all the looks back. And watching the Fail Mary game this week was sort of a good window, Brock, where you could look back and look ahead kind of at the same time, right? Because you get a chance to compare the Seahawks of 2012, then kind of the memory of what they became and now into today. By the way, 2012 does not look that long ago on TV.
No.
It's interesting. Like, there are some things you watch and you're like, man, that looks like another era. Watching Monday Night Football from 2012, which is now 8 years ago, look, could have been yesterday.
It could have been last year. Absolutely.
I know they've changed the graphics and stuff, but those graphics did not look out of date or, whoa, this looks crazy. I mean,
and both teams are still wearing the same jerseys.
Yeah.
And they, or I guess, Pete Carroll's still on
the
sidelines.
And to be fair, Tirico and Gruden were phenomenal.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Tirico's so good.
Yes.
Tirico's just so good.
So good.
The idea, I mean, what they've done since then, come on. I mean, Tirico is just, he was meant for that. It's so sad that he is not calling a national NFL game every week. He's so good at it. But it was fun to watch. It brought back a ton of memories. I can't believe that was Russ's third start.
Crazy.
Right? I mean, if you had asked me, hey, when was the Fail Mary game, I would have said Russell's, like, third season.
Correct.
Honestly, in my memory, he'd been around for a while. I remember going to that game and being there, and I remember the whole thing around. I guess I just wouldn't have put together that it was that early in his career. It's only his second win, right?
Correct.
Correct.
And remember, Mike, it was a few weeks after that where we sat with Pete Carroll on one of those Mondays, right? And talked to him both on and off the air, just kind of about where things were at. And, like, you know, I think the Seahawks were 4-4. And even in that game, he threw the one touchdown, but it's 13-7 with, you know, the final seconds left. You're talking about just 7 points scored in the entirety of that game, and it with your defense giving you 8 sacks in the first half.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, we kind of look back and go, man, had they lost that game? Had they lost that game? What if they were sitting there not at 4-4 and were 3-5? You know, would it have been a different conversation? And, you know, they were thinking anyhow about, hey, this thing's got to turn, right? We got to turn this thing. Russell's got to turn it. We got to give him a little bit more. And they certainly did in the second half of that season.
When I think of the 2012 season, I mean, I think of the Bears game and I think of the New England game as being sort of these momentous turning points. I guess I don't even think of the Fail Mary game of being 2012, even though obviously it was. And if I were to stop, I guess I would come up
with
that.
That's the craziest thing that stands out, is how fast the start of Russell's career was.
It's crazy.
You say that felt like year three. In year three, he went to his second Super Bowl.
I know.
He hasn't even been back to an NFC title game.
The Seahawks defense, I mean, you mentioned the 8 sacks, Brock, in the first half. Will the Seahawks have 8 sacks this year?
Are we going to do this like rapid fire? You want to do some little rapid fire
sure.
stuff here?
We can do it like rapid fire. Okay. Question one, will the Seahawks have 8 sacks this year?
Yes, but they will not have one player with 8 sacks.
How many games will it take to get to 8 sacks?
Four?
Five?
Five?
Like, no. Honestly, yeah.
I mean, they had, what, 28 last year?
Yeah.
And then the pass rush as of right now is taking a step back.
And that's fewer than two a game. Fewer than two a game, and they had Clowney.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a decent chance they don't put up 25 sacks this year.
Yes, there is. 100% true.
Yes. Yeah, it's kind of hard to watch the, and I think you texted this last night as you were watching it, Salk, or was in your notes for our podcast today, the speed with which that defense played.
Oh my God.
It's just a different game.
It was warp yes. speed. It's like watching
and
them at warp speed.
Credit to Gruden, who on that speed said both, man, you see this KJ Wright guy at yep. that point, he's in year two.
Okay,
this guy's
so going to
be a star.
He was so
he watches
fast.
Bobby Wagner year one. Man, this Wagner at yeah. middle linebacker, he can so fly.
And in the meantime, Cam's just late. How about, did you see the tackle Cam made on Greg Jennings in the open field? It's yeah. ridiculous.
Yes.
Jennings gets the ball, turns upfield. He finds Cam there running over, just the two of them in space. He gets by Cam, and Cam reaches out with one arm at the first down stick, grabs him, just hurls him to the ground. It's amazing. Yes. It is so freakish. We could talk yes. about all the guys on that team. Cam was my favorite, man. I loved watching Cam Chancellor play in his prime, the things he would do.
Greg Jennings in that game. He also got blown up by Browner in the
yes.
end zone. He's so mad. Browner just destroyed
oh, yeah.
him.
I mean, that team was so physical, so nasty, so fast on defense. And you know, do you see any of that now?
Not the last 2 years. I mean, that is where, I mean, you see some glimpses of it, right? We have certainly seen some glimpses of it. And Clowney, last season, when healthy, was the one guy that you would say, oh my gosh, yeah, put Clowney on that defense. You know, Clowney on that defense has 10, 11, 12 sacks, right? Clowney on that defense is even more disruptive because of the rest of the pieces that people have to deal with. Clowney's the one athlete on that Seahawks defense of 2019 that you look at and go, yep. Yeah, he'd have played in 12. Yeah, he'd have beat out whoever. Like, that guy was, and it still plays, you know, at a different kind of speed and twitch and quickness and aggressiveness and everything else. But, yeah, there's not many, many more components, Mike, that you look at. You know, could Shaq Griffin be a third corner on that 2012 team, 2013 team? Probably.
Yeah, maybe.
12.
Yeah, he could beat out Trufant in that year.
Right.
Trufant would come back to Costco in Atlanta.
Could he have beaten out Walter Thurman the next year? Or Byron Maxwell after that? I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, he might have.
Don't like that.
He might have, but it would have been a battle.
Yeah.
It would have been a battle. I mean, that
yeah, not many,
just...
not many pieces of similarity, and that's
the
why
one you
they
do
have...
see is like Marquise Blair, who we didn't see much.
That's right.
Marquise Blair looks like he's shot out of a can, like those guys.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly what I was going to say, Kyle. And that is why over the last couple years they've tried to draft and some draft capital that kind of looks and runs and you know hopefully can start to hit a little bit like that. Quandre Diggs last year in that San Fran game. So I'll call, this will be another rapid fire question because it kind of, you know, fit in with your note. When was the last time the Hawks defense made their opponent quit like that game, like the 2012 Packers? You know, after some of those hits, what happened? What did Jordy Nelson do when he caught a hitch route? He looked for grass to fall into.
And you saw that in 2014 and that the opening
Super
game.
Super Bowl II as well.
Well, yeah, the opening game of that where of that season where they were just
yeah.
like the Packers didn't want any part of them.
No.
They were done.
Nope, I'm not going to catch that flat route. I don't know if the cloud defender's coming down and Cam's going to rearrange my headgear. Right? I'm not running a little slant route in there. Are you kidding me? Bobby Wagner's going to knock my block off. I'm not running that. I know everybody now runs that deep over, but what if Cam is there right behind me as I catch it and he tears cartilage in my ribs like he did little Wes Welker in the Super Bowl, right? Like we teams are running the same plays against that same scheme, but there just isn't the finishing on the other end of it. I would say of over the last couple of years, when Quandre Diggs hit whoever he hit for the 49ers in San Francisco on that Monday night, they ran like a little in route, and he just cleaned the clock of that receiver. That was one of the first times where you, and how many drops did you see after that in that 49er game?
Mm-hmm.
There were actually receivers, Kendrick Bourne and a few of them dropped some passes. You're like, wow.
We've not Demaryius seen... Thomas in the Super Bowl. I mean,
correct.
Why did you just go back through those? I mean, like... You just have to do that.
Well, if you're going to run this system and you're going to go back to the roots of your system and you're going to play that kind of system, which they continue to do now, Pete's kind of...
When's the last time they played bump and run press coverage like that?
They'll still do that. And Shaq will still do some of that. And Trey will still do some of that, Mike. They'll still come up and play some of that press man.
A little. Not the way they did then, man. Yeah. Not the way they did then when they got those two, you know, pterodactyls on either side, just, you know, punishing receivers and just in their face. And I don't know. It doesn't seem like it looks the same for them on defense. And because of it, because the defense isn't where they need it to be, that's what opens up these questions about whether they need to open up the offense, right? Because in Pete's philosophy, it all kind of comes together. Everything works together.
It's a circle, Mike, like a Regenikind circle.
It absolutely is, but it makes sense. You've got a nasty defense because of your nasty physical defense that doesn't give up a lot of points or anything else. You are able to control the ball offensively, right? You run clock, you minimize possessions. Absolutely. You run it a couple of times, and then you let your defense come up with a turnover and help you. And that all makes sense. But when you take away the defense, which is what's happened the last couple of years, it does not look the same. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives rise and credibility, I think, to the let Russ cook people, because I don't think that in general, I get what Pete wants to do. I don't think it makes sense to just let Russell start throwing the ball over the yard. It doesn't fit with Pete's philosophy. But it does fit with having a defense that can't stop anything.
To a degree, I would also contend, though, when you do run the ball, when you do shorten the game, you put a defense that's struggling on the field less.
True.
Right? I mean, that's one of the things. Can you imagine if Russell was reckless with the football and turned it over and, you know, took some – well, we saw that at the start of 2018 – and they were 0-2, and there was a pick six, and you know, just ball, you know, and Schottenheimer had to have come to Jesus meeting and everything else.
Yeah,
because if you put that defense, you put the Seahawks defense last year on the field more, giving up 5 yards a rush, not taking the ball away, not getting to the quarterback, right? Yeah, you may score more, but you're going to put that defense on the field even more. And especially at this stage of KJ's career and you know, I think even Bobby's career with number of snaps, you'd sure like to see them play less snaps than more snaps, right? So, you know, that's where that circle all kind of completes itself. That's where Pete's going to be like, hey, man, this is where this all fits together. And you can take out one piece and try to make that argument, but I'm looking at it in totality. And, yeah, maybe we score more. And the argument would be, well, look at the Chiefs. Chiefs have a bad defense. So, yeah, if you got to just go out score people, is that what you want to do? You want Russell to play it, you know, and go into it and go into this upcoming season, say, hey, let's go. All right, Russ, we're going to let you cook, and you're going to outscore the 49ers, and you're going to outscore the Rams, and you're going to outscore the Saints, and you're going to outscore the Packers, and you're going to outscore in this NFC. You're going to have to do it each and every week. You're going to have to go out there, and you're going to have to outscore them and put 35 points a game on the board. That's how you want to go into attacking the season?
Well, I think, look, no, you and I are on the same side on this, but I think the argument would be from those who disagree with us, well, you're a lot closer to being able to do that than you are to actually bring back the defense that you used to have. So why not go the easy route and just try to do that?
Or maybe you sign...
That your personnel shows you right now that where are your stars? Where do you have the better chance of achieving a level of greatness? It's on offense. And Pete's just going to tell you, sorry, I want balance.
Yep.
Balance between the run and the pass game, balance between offense and defense. I mean, that's what he wants. And he is being stubborn. There's no doubt. I think Pete is being stubborn. I just think time will tell whether or not he's right or wrong about that.
So is this just stubborn on Clowney? Here's a rapid fire question for you. Question number 2 or 3 or 6. Is Clowney done in Seattle? Jaron Reed got his number 90 back. We didn't even, I don't know if that happened last week or we didn't talk about it on the podcast last week. But Jaron Reed got that number 90 back, and jerseys and numbers matter a lot to Mike Salk. Numerology is a big, big deal.
Here's what I assumed, because I still think Clowney will be back. My assumption was that Jaron Reed got his number back so that he could make more money off of Clowney if and when he has to give it back to him a second time.
So you think Reed's $10 million will be more than what Clowney makes?
I think it's a business decision.
Don't you think Clowney can cry poor and be like, sorry, dude, you got a multi-year deal.
He signs his new deal. Either way, like, hey, dude, if you can't afford the jersey, I'll take number 90 back.
That's what Schneider told Danny and Gallant on the number switch.
Yeah, I think you're buying into it because I don't remember approving that yet. So I don't know. Man, I don't know where that came from, but yesterday morning it was definitely something was going on.
Oh. Is John in charge of numbers?
Evidently. Well, he's a numerologist.
This is a whole, this is much big. We're burying the lead. John Schneider's in charge of who wears what number?
Start the podcast over. Start it over.
What? That's unbelievable.
Well, then who do you want to talk to him about? You got any complaints? I mean, we got a KJ Wright out of 50 to begin with. Right. I know he's been in that for a decade, but yikes.
It doesn't look right. Never has.
Big zero on him. He looks like a lineman.
I mean, I don't know. I'm reading a tweet here, Schneider, on April 29th at 10:11 a.m. from Jaron Reed himself at LJ_Reed. To clarify all questions, yes, I am back in number 90. With his own, you know, the number 90 right there, his avatar.
Maybe he doesn't mean in his football uniform. Maybe he just means, like, when he's walking around.
Yeah, it's like on his tank top.
Exactly. Yeah, at home, PJs. I'm number 90. At work, I still wear 92 or whatever he switched to.
Yeah, right, well, you know, whatever I got to do there.
Yeah. I do, Brock, they have to bring in somebody. Like, what the heck? They cut those guys. They have tons of space now. Like, why? They have to be bringing in someone, and I'm surprised that the thing's not done with Clowney yet.
Would you rather have Everson Griffin, a name I brought up the other day, Logan Ryan? You know, there's still actually some dudes that can play, and they've been productive players.
Yeah, big
play
Snacks
Matthews.
Up in here.
Yeah,
Snacks Harrison's out there.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to have Clowney and Snacks.
Yeah,
and I think you could afford that. So let's go. Kick Clowney and Snacks.
Well, you're not affording that with what is still all on the roster. You're not affording that with McDougald. You're not affording that with KJ Wright at his number. You're not affording that at, you know, some of these other spots that we've talked about.
But you could absolutely, I think in both those cases, rework their deals.
I would think so.
Or cut them if you have to. So, I absolutely would like that. Get in Clowney, get in Snacks Harrison or somebody like him, and I think you're a better team. I promise I'll shut up about the sacks and everything else, but watching and looking at their roster now, the idea that they're going to compete defensively in their division seems ridiculous.
Yeah, well, it does go back to Marquise Blair has to take a step. And whether that's him playing a little bit of nickel, and there's been, you know, lots of questions of Parson Pete, and he's not been definitive on what that looks like. And I think he even said, hey, I'm not going to tell you guys what we're up to and what we're doing in that way. Or, you know, you did bring a Jordan Brooks in. And trust me, when you see Jordan Brooks play, he's going to look like those guys and play at a speed that those guys were capable of playing. I'm not going to say he's going to be as productive or as impactful right away, and he's got a lot to learn, and his system at Tech is a whole different system than he's got to learn here, and it's a whole different game, right? This is not intramurals anymore. You're in the NFL, not in the Big 12. But as far as running and hitting at 240 pounds, running sub 4.5, that to your eye will start to look a little bit like what you watched last night.
Because they need some of that. And yes, all those things could happen, Brock, and it'll help. But it won't matter unless they can get to the quarterback. It just won't.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love for Marquise Blair to take over one of the safety spots. I'd love for it to be him and Quandre Diggs all year long. But it won't matter if nobody can get to the quarterback. It won't matter.
25. Okay, so here's the next little rapid fire, if you don't mind. 25 rookies are now on the Seahawks roster. With all their undrafted rookie free agents and all the moves that they made, will any of them have a DK Metcalf-like impact? And further, do they need one or two of them to do so in order to surpass the Niners, Packers, Saints, everybody else in the NFC?
Probably. The second question is yes. What's the answer to the first?
Can any of them have that kind of impact?
No, not statistically. I mean, could Damian Lewis go out there and start 16 games and give this team a huge lift? Yes. It wouldn't show up on the stat sheet like DK Metcalf did, but it could be as impactful, I think.
You think he could play at a level as a rookie with no offseason coming in to the NFL?
Not a Pro Bowl level like DK Metcalf did.
Yeah,
but,
hard to imagine.
Could he come in and be a starter and help this team? I think so.
I mean,
of a higher level than Fluke or Jamarco Jones or those guys have played in that position?
The only real potential answer on this question is Daryl Taylor, right?
Let's hope so.
I don't believe the answer is yes, but just based on position, and it would be him. But I look at Bruce Irvin and I look at Frank Clark as being two guys that kind of come before him playing similar-ish positions. Yeah. And neither of those guys contributed like that as a rookie. I mean, Bruce Irvin, you watch that.
In similar backgrounds, collegiately, as far as productivity and everything else, right? It wasn't like Frank Clark lit up the stat board at Michigan or Bruce Irvin and his trials and travails and you know, all over the country.
But look at the way they were both worked in as rookies, right? I mean, you get to watch in that Fail Mary game, Bruce had a couple of sacks, but he's basically coming in on third down fresh. Frank Clark, you remember he had that great preseason his rookie year, and then nobody could understand why he wasn't playing. He wasn't ready, right? Correct. I mean, so if those guys who ended up both being, you know, various levels of production later couldn't crack it early, it's hard for me to imagine that Daryl Taylor is.
Correct. But he's going to have a significant impact on right now. And even if Clowney is signed back, you are still going to need Daryl Taylor to come in and, you know,
on third and long and rush the passer.
And if John Schneider was considering Daryl Taylor at pick 27, or if they traded back to 30, then that tells me he thinks he can come in here and have an impact as a rookie.
And, you know, John will tell you that he's a guy that ran like sub 4.6 coming off of a broken leg that much the same way they looked at Frank Clark's explosion and how unique he was and why they took some of the risk that they, not some, why they took the risk to take him in the second round with his background at that time was they just felt he was unique athletically, and they feel the same way about Daryl Taylor. And he's got to come screaming off that edge. It goes back to kind of what you led with of how different that defense looked that Tirico and Gruden commented on.
And by the way, that's before Averill and Bennett are here.
Pre-Averill
and Bennett.
Yes.
I mean, and Bobby's a rookie, and KJ's in his second year, and Earl's, I mean, but they're so fast.
Well, can Marquise Blair in year two? Can Jordan Brooks, like Bobby, in year one? Can Daryl Taylor come in?
But if you don't have anyone to rush the passer or occupy blockers up front, it doesn't matter. That's my point.
Do you not?
Yes, they were able to do all those things, Brock, but they had Brandon Mebane, and they had Clinton McDonald, and they had Alan Branch
and Jason Jones.
Those are good players, not to mention the fact that Chris Clemens was on one edge. I mean, and they had Red Bryant. They were better. They were better across the board.
Yes.
So you're right. Even if the two safeties are as good as Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor, which they're not, but if they were, still wouldn't be enough.
Yeah.
It still wouldn't be enough for them to play the kind of defense they want to play.
And even more so in 2020 than in 2012, you have got to get to and impact the quarterback. And it's harder today because Aaron Rodgers isn't sitting there holding the ball. You don't have so many of these systems. You have systems more playing in space. You have systems getting rid of the ball. You have the ball out of quarterback's hands like Garoppolo and Goff and in your Kyler Murray, who know how to get rid of the ball and get rid of the ball quickly. So it makes it even that much more difficult to impact the quarterback, and why it's that much more of a priority to make sure you can go and get that done.
You know who else looked fast in that game? Russell.
Russell looked way fast.
And Aaron Rodgers.
Really?
He looked so much faster. I mean, he slowed down, I think, a lot over these 8 years. He looked pretty fast a couple times he took off run. I was like, man.
You know who didn't
Aaron Rodgers
look fast?
Run.
Cedric Benson.
No.
Like, wait, Cedric Benson?
He was done.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he didn't look
Whoa.
Fast. But Russ looked really fast. A couple of times he took off, like, whoa. Remember that? That was pretty fun watching Russ.
He tuck it on a like third down. Fast and elusive.
You want Cam Newton to back up Russ?
I really don't.
Really?
No.
Talk about vanquishing your foes. I mean, that's sort of like the old idea of Colin Kaepernick coming in. Like, sorry, man. You're my backup now. Sorry we had all
Pat
those
battles.
Pat
him on the head. Thanks, Cam.
I'll tell you what. If nobody's going to sign Cam Newton, why wouldn't you want him as your backup for no money?
Yeah.
At some point, you got to say yes to that. Right?
Well, we do, but the Seahawks prefer to have like Trevon Boykin and RJ Archer and like total chumps who can't play.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it's just all about, hey, it's Russell's team, and it would cut down some of Russ's credibility to have Cam Newton there. Cam's a star. I mean, Brock, remember when we ran into Cam? I mean, like, he flashes star power whenever you see him. I don't know. Like,
if Doug Baldwin was in that locker room, you can't bring in Cam Newton.
Right, but he's not.
But Doug's gone.
It's clearly Russell's locker room. So could you?
Yes.
And could you have Cam in a little package where he comes in and runs some power run game on third down? Or
Cam on third down, not on offense, though, right?
Would you
put him
Russ
on the edge. Turn him loose. You don't think Cam could play a little DN?
That guy can rush the pass.
Absolutely he can.
He's a tank. That guy's built.
Exactly.
It was fascinating, right? I think it could create a little bit of a conversation starter that if, you know, and even Andy Dalton, you can further add to this. Like Andy Dalton signs a 1 year. Now he got $3 million, upwards of $7 million in incentives, whereas Jameis got 1 year, $1 million, I think upwards of $3 million in incentives. So yeah, if you were to, and Cam Newton gets to a point here where there is just simply no market for you.
Yeah.
Sorry. So what are you going to do? Where are you going to go? And ultimately, what do you want? I think the poll ended up 38% of people said no.
Well, yeah.
Even at 1 year, $1 million, too much drama, too much background, too much about him.
I'll take that in a flash. $1 million on Cam?
Too much noise.
Sold.
Noise, Mike. We don't need noise. Colin Cowherd's like noisy. It's noisy.
I get that.
We don't need noise.
Is Cam Newton the best running back on their roster today?
Healthy?
I don't know. Did I send you guys a picture of DJ Dallas wearing 31?
No.
Told us he was going to wear 30.
DJ Dallas should be wearing 44.
Bro, I text you the picture.
Come on.
Now you have to ask John Schneider. I don't know if John has agreed to that.
Well, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Sorry, Cam.
Maybe he'll just buy 42 off Leno or wait for Leno to get cut.
No, I thought I thought I sent you guys the image. None of it looked good. None of it. The 31 didn't look good. The whole thing together didn't look very good. So, is he the best running back? Would Cam be the best running back right now on the roster with Carson out? Shout out, DJ Dallas and Homer, and a bunch of undrafted free agents. Yeah, probably, Salky, probably. Certainly the most production running the football in the league.
All right, to finish it off, an all Brock Heward edition of Which Is Better.
Yeah, I was feeling it last night as I shot the note to you. I was feeling it.
Yeah, Brock created all these Which Is Betters. I had nothing to do with it. It's all Brock. Did I tell you how I taught my kids Which Is Better?
You did. Was that on a walk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're making them defend it, though. Like, they can't just give an answer.
Right.
We went to, like, which is more useful, a fork or a spoon?
You're getting a fork.
Heated battle. Fork. Which is funnier, a duck or a cow?
Duck.
Right?
Big time duck.
Ultimately, the winner, we took all the animals in there. The one that came out as the funniest animal was the goat.
The goat is hilarious.
Hilarious.
Yeah. I got two goat neighbors, Diego and Pablo. Hilarious goats.
I bet they are. Full of personality. All right, here you go. Brock Heward edition of Which Is Better. Which is better, 80-degree day in May or 80-degree day in September?
I'm going to say 80-degree day in September. And I think we're going to hit I think we're going to hit 80 here in May this weekend. And I say this because all it is in May is a tease.
No.
It's a teaser, and then it can rain and hit in the 50s and be nasty. And we have had awful Junes before. Awful. Awful Junes. And I think even last year was an awful, awful June. So all it does in May is kind of tease you that the sun is coming, and it's still not going to. Whereas in September, you've had August, July's beautiful, and you just kind of reminisce and like, oh, this is just
you're
still
giving
so
all nice. The reasons why May is better
the
than September.
The 80-degree day in May is so much more unexpected.
Right, 80-degree nope. September. It's like, yeah, all right.
Now, yeah,
October,
nice
now you might have a conversation if all of a sudden you get a real, you know, but
I don't like
I
being
expect
teased.
It to be close
I don't like
to 80
teases.
In September.
I don't like teases.
Yeah, I expect it to be almost
when it was
80 in September.
70 degrees, October 20th, game right. day in Pullman. Now that was
there
like,
you go.
That
October,
was
yes.
Heaven.
May defeats September. Sorry, Brock. Not close.
Okay. All right.
Which is better, Rob Riggle or Will Ferrell? Here's the thing.
That's not even
Rob Riggle's terrible.
Rob Riggle's unfunny.
He
could take something funny and make it unbearably not
the
funny.
The moment I see him on screen, I turn it off.
Immediate channel change.
I couldn't change the channel fast enough when Rob Riggle is on.
He disgusts me.
Really?
He is not
like
funny
as a human?
At all.
As a
I
human?
Find his humor repulsive.
I totally agree.
It's not even humor. It is just
he's Chris. Yuck. He's Chris Kattan level unfunny.
Correct.
Wow.
That's like as bad as it can get in terms of comedy.
When
me.
They put poor Rob Riggle out there on the Fox NFL pregame show, I'm like, do you have to embarrass this guy again? Like,
yeah.
Really?
Brock, I know he's your teammate now, but I got to tell you. Rob Riggle's not funny. So whatever you think of Will Ferrell, maybe love him, maybe not, it's not close.
Correct.
Did you enjoy Will Ferrell as Greg Olsen?
I'm not like a huge Will Ferrell fan. Like, I like Will Ferrell at times. He's not my favorite. Yeah, it was fine.
It's some good material. Hey, yeah. I don't play special teams, Coach Schneider.
Right. Like, I mean, he's funny. I like that Will Ferrell's willing to kind of go for it.
How does Cord look to you?
How's what?
Oh, his Will core. Ferrell's, yeah, oh, he's showing off his abs.
You didn't even watch it, Saul. You didn't even watch Will Ferrell. You're not a Will Ferrell
no,
guy.
I didn't watch it. But I don't mind Will Ferrell. I just don't, like, he's just not my favorite. There are things he's done that I find very fun. Like, I love Old School. There's some moments for Will Ferrell I love, but he's not one of my favorites.
I will say this about this quarantine. I don't know if you found this to be true in your guys' lives. As I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. This is one of those moments where I should have a filter, but I'm not going to. I think the quarantine has aged old, like middle-aged guys much more so than the middle-aged women. I look at on some of these Zoom calls, like Damon's friends. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
they've gone from like 45 to 65. Will Ferrell looked like he was
Will Ferrell
70,
looked so old.
70 years old.
Who looked older, Will Ferrell or Olsen, who he was trying to imitate?
Will Ferrell looked older than Pete. A lot older. A lot older.
All right, more from Brock Heward, which is better. Which is better, Korean baseball on ESPN or classic Mariner games on Root?
Are you going to watch? Have you watched
yes
either?
Yes to both. Absolutely.
Your
but
yes
I was
on
trying
both,
to watch
huh?
last night, and the Korean League was like postponed by a fire. So it's like, wait, what? Okay, which was also interesting. But Daeho's out there, so I know you're going to watch Daeho.
I think Taylor Motter's out there, too.
Oh, yeah, he is. Motter Pops?
Yeah, it's like the 2000
Mariners. So you watched, Salk, you went and watched games in Japan, correct?
Yes, a game.
And you loved it?
It was great.
Will that translate to TV with no fans? Because
no.
Wasn't part of the experience
no,
there
it will not.
The fans and
yes.
the energy and the buzz. And
the food and the fact that yes. you're in Tokyo? Yes, that
yes.
was all part of it.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. But
the buzz? What kind of buzz?
Well, you got like the people walking around, like the beer vendors who wear like
backpacks. Oh, I just thought you meant the beer buzz.
Yeah, well, that too.
Whoa.
Oh.
But you got backpack. They wear backpacks. The girls wear backpacks with the beer on them, the little hose.
Kegerator
they,
on
yeah,
them?
Basically.
Wow.
And they like pour your beer at your
They sell octopus balls?
Yes, full fried octopus balls.
Yes.
We're good. Which is better, St. Patrick's Day or Cinco de Mayo?
St. Patty's Day this year was tough because I think we were in the lockdown or just starting
to Cinco de Mayo.
No, I know, but at least we're on the hope end of it, right?
Got
we're
coming
phase
up close
one.
To phase two.
Yes, changing the dial to phase two here quickly. Is it Jameson whiskey or tequila? Is it
we need a
you know,
Scottish
for,
holiday
Guinness or Modelo?
Right.
Is it
they're both good. You see, you don't need to choose here. I Well, I guess it's which is better.
Well, I mean, it's
it's actually the game
Mike,
I invented.
You have to choose.
Yes.
And the food puts Cinco de Mayo over
I'm
going
to go
top
Cinco, no Cinco de Mayo because of the idiots celebrating like the amateur hour that is St. Yes. Patrick's.
And they're eating like blood sausage and boiled potatoes.
That blood sausage is terrible. Remember we had it was awful.
And it's 42 degrees and cloudy in mid-March.
Yeah. This is a no-brainer. You're right.
Yes.
I'm convinced. It's Cinco de Mayo.
Thank you.
You don't have to choose.
Yeah,
hey, you do.
My bad. Sorry, strike that from the record. Obviously, we're done here. Obviously, we're all done. Brock, it has been fun. Thank you for another fantastic podcast. Hopefully, they'll play another classic Seahawks game so I can look at them and go, I don't remember who that guy is. To players, like, what was his name? Frank Martin? Who was that
Charlie
guy?
Martin. Charlie Martin. No, Evan Moore.
Not a real
Charlie
person.
Charlie Martin. Watch your mouth.
Frank
Show
Martin.
Some respect.
Frank Martin, I remember. All right, we got to run. We'll catch you guys soon. Until then, the hay.
Barn.
See everybody.